Welcome once again to Saturday Java with Jason. I am Jason Coffee Man. This is where we meet with guests, drink coffee, and just have a great conversation.
Hey, I'm here with Brian Gillette. He does coaching, leadership, perseverance, all that. He's an author of Epic Performance, and it's available on Amazon. I'm going to take the time and turn it over to Brian Gillette so he can give you an introduction of what he is and what he's about and all that good stuff.
Hey, Jason, it's great to be on your show. Look forward to chatting about what's going on. So there's two sides to my world. One is I do a lot of executive coaching and facilitating of executive retreats, and that's the leadership development. That's the corporate side. But on a personal side, I do a lot around adventures and endurance events. So the title of my book, Epic Performance, the full title is Epic Performance, Lessons from 100 Executives and Endurance Athletes on Reaching Your Peak. And I went out and I interviewed 100 kind of high level performers. You know, most of them were on the C-level area. And then about a quarter of them were also ultra distance athletes. People had done like an Ironman or run 100 miles. And having sat in both of those seats, I wanted to understand what are the behaviors that both of them demonstrate and how can you be successful?
Now, endurance, that's really up my alley because I read a few of Jocko Willick's books and David Goggins. They are both high endurance, kick-ass people. So is it kind of like that way, or is it more marathon, or how does that go?
Well, so when I interviewed, the 100 people, if you were going to be part of the interview and on the ultra distance side, you had to do the equivalent of an Ironman or more. And so that could have been an Ironman. It could have been a 100 mile run, you know, something like that. I spoke to one guy who rode his bike from the north of Africa to the south of Africa. You know, I spoke to a couple people who had done 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents. Myself, I've ridden my bike across the United States, 4,000 miles, and then also done a 200-mile run around Lake Tahoe, so 76 and a half hours. And then just completed, my family and I were down in Antarctica in early January of this year, and just completed a marathon running 315 laps around the ship for 26.2 miles down in Antarctica. So it's people that have done some pretty long distance events, at least on the ultra distance side.
See, this is one thing. That's one reason why I kind of started my podcast, to get people off their ass and motivation. And there's a lot of books I read about that. And something I say, my listeners are probably going to get mad at me for saying this, but, you know, you can't run a marathon in one day, but you can go tie your shoes one day, walk to the end of the driveway one day. It's just a matter of compounding everything and just moving. Getting motivation.
You're having that purpose. You know, when we think of epic performance, so what epic stands for is the E in epic is how do you envision the thing? So you got to be able to see what the finish line of a marathon looks like. The P is how do you put a plan in place in order to do it? The I, and this is what you were talking about, Jason, the I is iterate. How do you work your way up to the marathon? You don't start off running 26.2 miles. You start off running 2 miles, and then you do 3 miles, and then 4 miles. So the C is how do you collaborate and learn from other people who've done it? And then lastly, you have to go out and perform it. I remember when I did my first marathon years ago, I thought, okay, I want to go out and run a marathon. And I was in really good biking shape. I had been, you know, I could easily bike 100 miles. I had completed a 300-mile bike ride in 24 hours the year before. And I went out and I ran, just got up, went out, bought some shoes and ran 4 miles. And I came back, and later in the afternoon, I had to walk upstairs and my legs just hurt. I thought, oh my God, I'm glad I don't have to run 26.2 miles today. But then the next day you run next week you run 5 miles and 6 miles, and you work your way up until, as you said, you're at 26.2.
And one of the things that I like is I listen to Andy Frisella. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but he talks about the critical task list. Make a list of 5 things you want to get done every day. And I kind of look at that as something to do, because if you want to make something, you want to run a marathon in a year, put on there what you want to do in 6 months, then break that down again, 3 months, break that down. So every day, every week, every month, you're accomplishing something closer to your goal.
I couldn't agree more with you. I mean, you do have to, and that's what the plan part is. The P in EPIC is put your plan together. What is it you want to accomplish in the next year? And a lot of what, you know, we tend to think fairly short term. And I'm kind of encouraging people, think 10, 20, 30 years out. You know, what is it you want in life 30 years out? You know, there was a good book about a woman who wrote about, she was a nurse, a home healthcare nurse, and she wrote about interviewing people in the final stages of their life. And kind of she was asking them, you know, about their situation and if they had any regrets. And most of them had, if they had regrets, they were regrets about things they didn't do, Jason, versus yeah. the things they did do. And so how do you identify those things in life that, all right, in 20 years, I want to do X, and then back into it. And most people, you know, they think, oh, okay, I want to run a marathon. I can't run a marathon. And in reality, maybe you can't run a marathon today, but what do you have to do to run it tomorrow? And often, you know, when I'm kind of thinking about working with people on this, I'll say, okay, what is it you can do in the next 72 hours, the next 72 hours that will move you forward in whatever pursuit you're trying to do? And it doesn't have to be big. In fact, chances are it's going to be small, but the next 72 hours, what can you do?
That's awesome. And let me just tell people out there, we're not just talking about just exercise. We're doing this for life. We're losing weight, promotions, anything like that, going back to school, whatever you have to do, it can be kind of used with the basis of life, even because life can be looked at as a marathon. You know, you start and the end is when you die, but the middle of that is life. So if there's something you want to accomplish, make a goal to get there. Maybe you want to be your own business owner. Maybe you want that promotion that's offered. Maybe you want this. Maybe you want that. This, I bet, can be used for regular life too.
You're absolutely right. I mean, when I interviewed the people, the 100 people, you know, I had about 75% were executives or founders of their own company. And then about 25% were in the ultra distance side. Some had both. And I wanted to understand, did they share common traits? Were their common behaviors? And that's what, there were a lot of commonality. I mean, all of them were extremely focused. You know, we have 168 hours in our week. And the people that are really good at getting things done know how to use those 168 hours. And so when somebody says, oh, you know, I can't fill in the blank, I can't go to the gym. Well, it's, you just haven't prioritized that. And so how do you get extremely focused on what you want this year, next year, and into the futures? And the other one is, you know, they had this kind of can-do attitude, very optimistic. When they ran against, you know, would run into a wall, they would figure out, okay, now maybe I need to go a different direction. Let me try to go around the wall or over the wall or under the wall. And so there was just a tremendous amount of optimism, a bunch of different characteristics that were similar. You know, those are just two of them. And so how it doesn't apply just to exercise or running a marathon. One woman I worked with, she wanted to start her own business. And so she was working in the corporate world and she wanted to move in and do some human resources consulting. And so we talked to her. It's like, okay, you know, what is it? When do you want to do it? And she wanted to do it in about a year. It's like, okay, what do you have to do in that next year in order to prepare you? What is it? You know, and I even asked her the question, okay, in the next 72 hours, what can you do? And she said, well, I could at least get a website. Okay, do that. And then in the next 72 hours after that, what are you going to do? and just keep repeating.
And what I like is there's no age limit. I don't want to hear, and probably Brian and everybody else doesn't want to hear, I'm too old to do it, or I'm too set in my ways, because I remember not even a year ago, I believe he was 80 years old or somewhere around there. He accomplished the Appalachian Trail. He was the oldest man to do it, and yeah. he did it, which is like 2,000 miles, something like that. Yeah. And he did that, and he was 80. So, you have the 18-year-olds out there right now getting out of school. Don't say, well, I don't know how to do something. There's ways to learn. There's ways to do it. So, and if you are 60, you know, there's no age limit to conquer what you haven't conquered already.
I agree. I mean, the oldest person to run a marathon, I think, was 100. My dad, a couple years ago, he's 85. He just walked across Ireland. I have another friend right now in his late 60s, early 70s, I believe it is. He's walking from Southern California, from San Diego up to San Francisco. And he last summer, he walked from England to Rome. So, yeah, that I'm too old. Now, granted, Jason, I'm not going to go out and be the fastest marathon runner in the Olympics. That, you know, I'm well past that. But, and so there are some things yet that age does impact, but too often we say, hey, I'm too old to run a marathon, you know, hike the Appalachian Trail. And it's just an excuse in many cases. I agree with you, Jason.
Another thing too is I heard another quote. You might laugh at this one. You might disagree, but I don't quit when I'm tired. I quit when I'm done. So if you don't finish the race, at least you tried.
Right.
And that's more than a lot of people do. I also read a book which was called The 80-20 Rule. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of that, but 80% yep. of what 80% of what you try or 80% of what you get comes from 20% of what you actually try to do.
I love it. And when we quit, often we're quitting because our brain is telling us to quit. Our legs have more in it, or our arms have more in it. And I've done enough long distance. I've done a 200-mile run. I've done a 100-mile run. I've cycled, 4,000 miles or 300 miles in one day. And I know what it's like to just be mentally and physically exhausted. Often when we quit, though, we quit because our brain is telling us I can't go further or I'm too tired, when in reality, you probably have a little bit more in the legs. And so while running 200 miles, around Lake Tahoe is physically demanding and extremely hard on the body, at the end of the day, the people who finish are the people who are mentally stronger, because it's going to be the people that just mentally tell themselves, I can't go further. That's going to stop them.
Well, what I did, I'm not sure if you know of it, it's called 75 Hard. People call it a fitness program. It's a mental program. For those who don't know, it's 75 days of drinking a gallon of water, exercising twice a day for 45 minutes, taking a picture, no alcohol, staying on a diet with no cheat meals, all this stuff. And I heard only 5% of the people actually make it through on the first try. Wow. Because it's a mindset.
It is. Yeah. It's a mindset. And you've got to have the kind of, why am I doing this? And that helps a lot is, why am I pursuing this? I spoke to one gentleman, just very successful executive, ran his own engineering company and also an Ironman. And I asked him, it's like, what keeps you going when you're training for those Ironmans? Because that takes a lot of time. and he goes, well, I think about how I don't want to die on the couch like my uncle did. I said, well, tell me more about that. He goes, well, I saw my uncle, he got injured, and then he sat on the couch and he didn't get up. And when he didn't get up, he gained more weight. And when he gained more weight, it was harder for him to get up. And so he didn't move. And so there was that kind of downward spiral. And so I didn't want that to happen to me. And eventually he died. And he goes, so when I know I have to get up at 4 or 5 in the morning and go for a bike ride or a swim or a run, I think of that and think, okay, I don't want that to happen to me. And so part of it is understanding, okay, what is it in this big endeavor, whether it's athletic, whether it's business, what is it that's going to keep you moving forward when it really gets hard? Because it will really get hard, and you have to know kind of why you're doing this and how you're going to keep moving forward. So having those in your back pocket is a good thing to have.
Now, one thing I do want to touch on, because is the mindset. What you're telling yourself is one thing. But when you have people around you who are the negative people, the Karens, those saying, dude, you can't do it. Dude, this long ways. Oh, you just started running and, you know, it's 26.2 miles. But geez, you have 25.2 miles left. That's so far. Why don't you just quit?
Find what other people to hang around.
Yep.
Sorry, I interrupted you on that, Jason, but if you kind of, that, you know where I'm going to go on this.
You know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
All right. But the thing is, though, is what I love to say to people, too, don't cut those people off. Don't kick those people out of your life. Keep them in your life, because then you can rub it in their faces when you do accomplish what you've set out to do.
That is a definite strategy. I tend to hang around people that have that kind of more optimistic, because optimism breeds optimism. And when you see other people that are successful, I mean, I run every weekend with a group of people who, you know, many of them have done a 100-mile run or an Ironman or some long distance event. And so when I was training for a 100-mile run, you know, in most circles, people would be going, oh my God, that's crazy. I could never do that. In the circle of people that I'm hanging around with, it's like, yeah, that's normal. And I realize it's not normal. So I'm of the view of the people that if they're telling you can't do it, what it really means is they can't do it. So don't let them take you down. But I tend to focus on the people who are like, oh yeah, you can do it versus the people that are saying you can't do it. Cause they will bring you down, and the more optimistic people will make you realize what you're doing is pretty cool.
And I'm nowhere near what you did. I actually did a 50-mile bike ride on a BMX bike. So what you're doing now, I know I have to work my way up to it, but I give you so much props, because I mean, I know the hell it took to do that. And after I was done, I couldn't even ride my bike another like 10 feet. I was exhausted. But there's a difference of, for those people out there knocking the other people, go out there and try to do what they're doing before you put them down. Because are you putting them down because you can't do it, or are you just that negative of a person?
And what you did, a 50-mile bike ride, whether it was on a BMX bike or a, you know, super, you know, high-powered, road bike, is still hard to do. And you kind of persevered through the challenging times. And often, you know, we'll talk to people and they'll say, okay, I'm just going to run a 10K. And my view is not just, I mean, that's still a pretty big accomplishment. If you've never run a 10K and that's what you're going to do, it's like, own it and go out and do it. Because don't compare your 10K to somebody who's used to running marathons. You know, you should own that, and you should be proud of it, and go out and enjoy it as much as you can. So, riding 50 miles is an impressive feat, because most people haven't done that. I mean, you look at a marathon, the statistics I've read is only 1% of the U.S. populations run a marathon. Only 1%, when I think probably 99% could.
Another thing too is, I look at it like this. If you want to have somebody really stick by you, get somebody that's ran a marathon and say, hey, look, I'm going to go do a 5K. Would you like to do that with me?
Yeah.
A lot of times those people be like, yeah, because they know that you're working your way up. And even though that's nothing to them, they might not break a sweat, but they're going to look up to you for at least trying it.
I agree. And it's fun. Like, I love it. There's a client of mine, and she was training for a half marathon. And so we talked a lot. And the work I do with her has nothing to do with running. It's all around executive retreats. And I was so excited for her. And you know, I would call her up every once in a while and say, hey, how's your training going? And I know there was a little bit of accountability that she knew that if I'm sending her a note, you know, she didn't want to respond back and saying, yeah, no, I haven't done anything. And so I think it was good for both of us. And so, find that person. And, you know, they're an accountability partner. Find that person who will kind of be excited for you, who will get you going, who will help you. And that's kind of what, you know, when you look back at Epic Performance, the C is about collaboration. Somebody's done this before. Somebody's run a marathon. Somebody's run 200 miles. Somebody's started up their own company. And so talk to those people, get them on your side and learn from them. You know, a good friend of mine who is a swimmer, just an amazing swimmer. You know, at one point in his career, he swam for the Colombian national team. And so now he just lives around the corner from me. And he holds the record for swimming across Lake Tahoe. He swam, which is 11 miles. He swam the kind of north to south, which is 22 miles. And now he's training for the English Channel, which is about 21 miles, I believe. And he calls me up and he says, hey, Brian, and you need a crew when you do that. And you need somebody, you have a boat that follows you. And he says, hey, Brian, will you be on my crew? And will you be in the boat? And I'm not a swimmer. So, you know, if you want somebody that knows swimming, I'm not the person. But I know that mental mindset. I know what it takes. I know what somebody needs. And when they're 10 hours into an event, it's like, I'd love to. You know, I'll go to England with you and I'll be in the boat with you and the rest of your crew. Because, you know, it's fun for me. But it's also good to know that, I'm going to help. I'm going to play a small part in his ability to get from, you know, England to France.
Now, Brian, if I want to tell you I'm going to go run a marathon this summer, how much training will it take to go from couch to marathon?
You know, I would say you probably want to spend at least 4 months. But the hardest part of that is signing up. So if you want to do that, here's what I would suggest is look 4 to 6 months out for a marathon that's going to excite you, whether it's in a city that you want to do, you want to visit, you know, whether it's local where you know your family can be there, and then sign up. Often the hardest part of running a marathon is signing up. And once you sign up, you've got a date on your calendar, and then you can back into it. And you can just Google marathon running plans. And it will tell you what you need to do. And you start off a couple miles a week, and then your long run may be 3 miles on a Saturday or a Sunday. And then the next week it's 4 miles, and then 5 miles, and then 6 miles. So just, you know, the key thing while you're sitting on that couch is pull up your phone or your computer, look for a marathon that you want to do, and then sign up. And then you can go start worrying about the other things.
Yeah, because one thing that I looked at was, I'm not sure if you ever read the books, but Goggins, You can't stop, you can't hurt me, and never finished. The guy has records that are, I believe, untouchable at this point, but he is kind of, I don't want to say my idol, but he's one of my heroes because of what he's done. So, and he's done one of the hardest things, I think, which is just running. He's done 4x4x48, which is 4 miles per 4 hours for 48 hours. Mm-hmm. I don't even think I could touch that. Seriously, that's a record that I wouldn't even want to try, just running that kind of thing.
Yeah, but then it's finding out what is it you want to do. And so you know, there's going to be some people that, you know, some of your listeners are saying, you know, I don't want to run a marathon. And if you don't want to do it, I get that. But if you're not doing it and you want to do it, but you're not doing it because you don't think you can, that's a different story. But if you come to me and you say, I don't want to run it, it's like, okay, that's fine. What is it you want to do? Do you like biking? Do you like swimming? Do you want to start your own company? Do you want to be vice president of X? So just really figuring out what is it you want, and then figuring out, you know, how can you go after that?
Okay. And now you're talking the book you wrote. I got to ask you, why? Why did you write it? What gave you the idea to write the book, and how long did it take you to do?
Yeah. So I remember in college, I took a course, and it was based off of Stephen Covey's Seven Habits. And this was before the book kind of went just crazy. It was like the year or two before the book really went wild. In fact, Stephen Covey knew our professor and came and spoke to us. And when he came and spoke to us, we had no idea who this big, tall, bald guy from Utah was. And then the next year, everybody knew who he was. And I remember writing down a bucket list. And that was, you know, one of the exercises we had to do in class. And one of the things I wrote was write a book. You know, there were a bunch of other things, but one was write a book. And I figured the reason was is because I wanted to be able to demonstrate a body of knowledge in something. And so, you know, a couple years, probably about 10 years ago, I was starting to formulate this idea and figuring out I had this body of knowledge. And after running, you know, the 200 mile run around Tahoe, and then another thing, you know, my family and I, I have two kids, and we took them out of school. My wife and I took our two kids out of school, and we traveled around the world for a year. And right before we were leaving, friends had a going away party for us. And a number of them came up and said, God, you know, I could never do what you're doing, meaning kind of go travel around the world for a year. And I've had other people say that. It's like, oh, I could never run a marathon. I could never run 100 miles. I could never do this. And I thought, you know what? There's a book there because you can. And so how do you move from, you know, I can't to I did? And so, you know, I started to put some ideas together. It's like, okay, I had gotten the idea of, all right, you got to be able to see it. You got to be able to do it. You got to kind of put that plan in place. You got to work your way up. You know, my wife and I didn't all of a sudden one day decide we were going to go travel around the world. We'd been planning it for 12 years. And we talked to a lot of other people or see the collaborate. And so, that was that idea of how do I put together something down on paper that is a practical guide of how do you think big, put it in place, and go and do it so people have some kind of some practical ways of reaching some of the bigger things they want to accomplish in life.
Now, what was when you traveled around the world, I know it's not like talk about running and stuff like that. What was the biggest awe moment of traveling? Like what took your breath away? Was it just the sunsets in some places, the sunrises in some places? What really stood out in your mind?
You know, I've done this twice. My wife and I, before we got married, we traveled for 7 months, just the two of us. And then a number of years ago, we took our kids around the world. And I think as a kind of what stood out the first time and was reinforced the second time is how good people are around the world. You know, we often worry about you're going into some city in or some country in fill in the blank, whether it's in Africa or Europe or South America. And people worry. It's like, oh my gosh, are you going to be safe in Colombia? You know, aren't you worried about being in the Middle East? And I just realized how good people are. You're going to have some bumps, but people are going to be there to help you out. And I remember, I mean, we spent 4.5 months in South America. We spent 4.5 months in Africa and some pretty rural places. We spent a month in the Middle East. One of the few places we had problems is I was on the Paris metro and somebody tried to rob me. So, you know, people think, oh, Paris, that's safe. You know, it's in a big city, whether you're in Paris or San Francisco or New York or, you know, Rio de Janeiro, that's where the risks are. And so it made me realize that, you know, one is, you know, people around the world are generally good and you're at much less risk than you think you are. So, you know, that was one of the big ahas, but, you know, there's a lot of places in terms of, you know, watching a sunset with elephants walking by or zebras or, you know, in Botswana, swimming in the Red Sea. I mean, just or tasting food in Lebanon. I mean, those things stand out as well.
I mean, I look at it like a lot of times people put themselves in predicaments. And then they blame the area they're in. And like if you go to New York City, you don't want to walk down a dark alley where there's nobody around. Stay with the crowds because more or less those crowds are there for a reason. If you start going into the shady areas, well, that's on you, kind of.
You do have to assess your risk. I remember the first time my wife and I traveled and we spent a majority of our 7 months in Southeast Asia and China. And at the time, avian bird flu was moving around kind of Asia a lot. And we talked to the doctor. We talked to our doctor before we left and said, all right, what do we have to prepare for? What do we need to worry about with like the avian flu? And he said, you know, the avian flu is not going to be the problem. It's going to be getting hit by a motorbike or a car or being in a car accident. And so it's being able to understand your risks. You know, is it safe to walk down a dark alley in some remote or in some city in New York or something? Yeah, you might want to be careful. But it's being able to understand, okay, where's the greatest risk and how can you mitigate that? Yeah, you know, we were in Turkey and there was a bombing that went off. And people think, oh my God, a terrorist activity. Aren't you afraid? The chances of me getting hurt from a terrorist activity are so low. And most of the time it happens at night. It happens in where a lot of people are hanging out. And so, and my wife and I didn't go out much at night. So it's like, yeah, manage your risk and then try to figure out how do you reduce it as much as possible. But oftentimes we let that fear kind of hold us back when in reality, there's probably not a lot of risk.
Now I'm going to ask you one other question. Food wise, what was the worst thing you had to eat in other countries? Because I know they have different exotic foods than we do. And what was your most favorite thing traveling the world?
Oh, food wise, I will eat almost anything. I'm not a big haggis fan. Sorry for all the Scottish folks.
Oh, come on. So, you see, I'm Scottish. I love haggis.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, Jay. if somebody puts something in front of me, I will at least try it. I remember my wife and I were in France with some friends, and she had ordered something. I forget exactly what it was. And I had ordered something and hers came and it just looked awful. I mean, it looked like every innards of a, you know, they took all the innards from somebody's body and they stuck them in a sausage and it looked awful. And she goes, I just can't eat it. And I said, I'll eat it. And I think it was more difficult to mentally eat it. And again, it goes back to that mental part. Often it's not the taste, but it's like, you know, like cottage cheese. I like cottage cheese, but there's a mental component that it's like, oh, it just kind of looks weird. So now I think you asked my favorite part about traveling around the world.
Well, your favorite food. Now that you did the disgusting part.
Favorite food? The food and the favorite food, I would have to say Vietnamese food. You know, of all the places I've been, and we had great food in Lebanon. I love Lebanese food. But Vietnamese food, I love the freshness of some of the vegetables. You know, they've got that French influence. The best chocolate mousse I've ever had in my life was in Vietnam. And it's not just, you know, chocolate mousse, but it's just all the fresh vegetables and the rice and the fish. So I could go to Vietnam again and eat. So whenever I hear somebody's going, my son's going to Vietnam this summer, and it's like, oh, you're going to love the food.
Well, there's one thing I can't do, and that's squid ink. I have spaghetti with squid ink, and I couldn't even do it.
I haven't tried it. I would try it, but I have not had that. So,
well, this has been a very interesting conversation because we talked a lot on this podcast, and I hope we touched a few places, Brian, that you wanted to touch. So people out there that do want to get a hold of you for information on coaching or leadership or just to have information about your book, how do they get a hold of you? Are you on Instagram, Facebook, anything like that?
So I am on Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn. I don't use Instagram too much. LinkedIn, if you look for Brian Gillette, and it's B-R-Y-A-N, Gillette, just like the razor blade. Or you can go to my website, which is epicperformances.com. And that's E-P-I-C performances with an S.com. And that's kind of the easiest way to connect up with me. And then it'll link to the book on Amazon. It gives you a way to connect with me. And I always love to kind of hear people's stories, like what's that big thing that they're looking to accomplish and hear those successes.
Okay, that's awesome. Thank you so much for your time, Brian. This has been awesome.
I appreciate being on your show. It's been good talking to you, Jason.
I'm always looking for likes, shares, and reviews. Please give it a share and a review. 5 stars really does help. Thanks for tuning in. Yes, refill both of our coffees. See you next week where we can listen once again. Please follow us on Saturday Java with Jason on Facebook and Instagram. And please follow me on Facebook at Jason Coffee Man.